Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And this week, we'll be hearing from director Rennie Harlin, who will be discussing his new horror reboot, The Strangers Part 1. And we'll also be reviewing John Krasinski's imaginary friend movie, If, grimy British debut, Horde, body horror Tiger Stripes, and documentary Catching Fire, the story of Anita Pallenberg. But first, Matthew, have you been watching anything else this week or been to any events?
Well, I'm still very caught up in the X-Men 97 animated series. I'm very much enjoying that. It's coming to an end now. It feels like it's whizzed past. So, I'm hoping for more. And I'll be going back and watching the original because I never saw that, the kind of one that started in the 92, which this is a continuation of. So I'll be going back into that. But yeah, I mean, as a big Marvel and particularly X-Men fan, I've been very happy and satisfied with this one. It's very sort of literate and sophisticated and kind of stays true to the characters, but also has this really great sort of banging action and sort of lovely sort of retro animation as well. It doesn't feel like it's making sort of concessions to today's sort of computer driven visuals while still, you know, looking like it can compete with sort of current animations as well. So, yeah, I'm really much very much enjoying that.
And so is it easy to get into if you haven't seen the original series?
I think so. I mean, I think by this point, most people are, if they haven't read the comics, they've seen the film. So they're kind of familiar with the film. So the characters, they kind of stay true to those sort of templates. You know, Wolverine is the kind of the grumpy, sort of grumpy, but decent kind of sort of feral one. And Magneto kind of goes back and forth between good and bad. He kind of straddles that line. So it feels like it's really kind of nailed on those characters and captured the dynamics between them. So I think anyone sort of picking this up for the first time, because yeah, like I said, I hadn't watched the original series. I think you'd swiftly get into it, definitely.
Awesome. And I've been to a couple of things this week. We both went to the Garfield movie on Sunday, but that's embargoed, so we can't really talk about that until next week's episode. But I also went to a kind of Q&A that was held at Abbey Road Studios, of all places, which was exciting. And that was for upcoming documentary The Beach Boys, which is produced and co-directed by Frank Marshall, the legendary producer and occasional director. And he's done this new sort of Beach Boys documentary feature that's going to be on Disney Plus on the 24th of May. And that the kind of film is under embargo, but the Q&A, which also featured Beach Boys, Bruce Johnston and Mike Love, as well as Frank Marshall. And it was hosted by Mariella Frostrup, of all people. And that was just very entertaining. They're kind of great stories and very much has got me on a listening to the Beach Boys again jag following that. So that was fun and just exciting to go to Abbey Road Studios as well. Because I've never been there before. Never been to the famous crossing. Yeah, that's what we've been up to this week. But kicking off the podcast proper now with this interview.
You are the messiest eater on the planet.
God, what's this going on? Watch the front door.
So this is The Strangers Chapter 1, which is a franchise reboot of that series. And as the title suggests, it's the first part in a new story. This one's going to be a three-part story. It's directed by Rennie Harlin, who's best known for action films like Cliffhanger, The Long Kiss Goodnight and Deep Blue Sea. Here he talks to online writer Megan Garside about approaching the invasion horror genre.
What drew you to The Strangers rather than any other horror movie? What makes this project stand out to you?
I love the original The Strangers. And out of the blue, the script, and I opened the file, and it was 280 pages long, which is about almost three times longer than a normal script. And then I realized that this was not about making a sequel or about doing a remake, but it was really about reimagining the whole Strangers world. And that, to me, was a great opportunity to pay homage to the movie that I loved, but not copying it or not just trying to add to it, but actually like creating my own world of The Strangers and having a chance, which nowadays streaming series have, which is they can tell a, you know, 6 or 8 episode story about certain characters and themes, as opposed to movies that are usually 1.5 hours, a couple hours long. So this was now a chance to do a 4.5 hour movie, break it into 3 movies, and really do an exploration of what makes this kind of a serial killer or killers, what makes them tick, what's behind it all, and also explore what happens to the victims of this kind of senseless violence. So it's just, in terms of like horror films, there are so many movies that have supernatural element and haunted houses or haunted dolls or haunted kids. And this felt like it being so rooted to reality, it really offered a great canvas to explore truly, truly horrific things.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the 2008 version that you mentioned. It's so well loved. Did this add any pressure when you were making this movie?
Definitely, a lot of pressure. I knew that I'm going to be judged against the original film. And our intention was really to make our own movie, our 3-episode movie, honor the original. I'm fully aware that there's going to be those diehard fans that no matter what we do, they are not going to be satisfied and will always be compared to the original. But I'm sure there's going to be also a lot of people who are like me, will feel like, okay, some of the questions from the original film will get answered and it'll bring certain closure and satisfaction, I think. And then, of course, new fans who haven't seen the original, who hopefully will get on this journey and enjoy it just as a new movie.
I feel like with your version as well, we're given a longer time to get to know the victims, and they have a much happier relationship in comparison to the couple in the other film. What was the reason behind this?
Well, it's really because we have more time, because we have 3 movies. I really wanted to develop the characters and make us understand them and learn to know them, so that will carry then over the 3 movies and really see also the change that happens to them. And I personally was a little torn by the original film's setup of the couple. I understand why it was done, but the fact that they, in essence, they are breaking up in that movie, I didn't want to do that. I wanted this to be a happy couple, because there are happy couples also in this world. So I wanted them to be in love and happy, and I wanted to really violate that perfect happiness with the utmost violent horror.
And this is the first film in a trilogy. Can you give us a little tease of what we can expect in the second movie? Are we going to get a stranger's origin story, maybe?
We will definitely get some answers. Not everything will be explained and made completely clean and nicely packaged with a bow on top, but we will definitely learn a lot more about the strangers and about what makes these kind of people tick. We'll get some answers to why they are doing this, where are they coming from, whether they've done it before and whether they'll do it again. We'll definitely, one thing I can reveal is that we will find out who Tamara is. I'm sure a lot of people have been wondering. We will learn who that person is. We will really explore, because needless to say, I think it's common knowledge that the central female character, Maya, played by Madeline Petsch, she will survive the first movie, and we will really explore what it means to survive this kind of horrible mental and physical torture and how it affects a person. So I think what really interests me is the whole psychological study of both the victim and the victimizers.
I don't want to spoil anything, but you keep the attacks and the kills in this movie quite simple, but they are very effective. What was the reason behind this?
Blood and gore are always part of horror films in one way or another, but I wanted this to be almost like a callback to 80s and 90s horror films, and be basic in a way that the horror is very, very much rooted to reality and the violence is very realistic. So it's not about squirting blood and things like that, though you will definitely, if you watch the 3 movies, you will definitely get your gore and blood for sure. But it wasn't about that. It's not about splattering blood all around. And it's just keeping it real. And I think real violence is brutal, but it's not so sensational. It's not so visually crazy as movies like to make it seem. Even if you go back to Hitchcock's Psycho, it's the things you imagine you see more than what you see. In Hitchcock's Psycho, you see a woman being killed with a knife in the shower, and you imagine that it's the most violent and bloody thing you've ever seen, but you don't really see ever the knife enter the woman's body, and you don't see wounds and squirting blood, but you imagine much more. And that's what I wanted the audience to be able to do, to really feel it in a visceral way, like really feel like they can imagine themselves in that situation and the pain and horror without, you know, hitting them in the face with the blood.
In terms of the gore again, even though it's not super gory, it does have a 15 rating. Did you have to like trim anything to make it fit this 15 rating, or was that always the plan?
No, the movie was the movie, and we knew that it's going to be having some restrictions for sure. Even if we cut down on the violence, it is just the whole mentality of the movie. It's so tense, it's so frightening, and it's the reality that makes it so frightening. Because anybody can relate to that situation. Anybody could find themselves in that situation. So I think the atmosphere of the movie is so horrible that there's no way little young kids should be watching it.
Now, you've made quite a few horror movies over your career. Did you learn anything from these past movies that you took into The Strangers?
Definitely. I feel like I learn from every movie, always. And I think that in horror films, creating the scares, it's almost like you could compare it to a good comedian telling a good joke. It's that you have to have a setup, then you have to take the audience on this journey of building up their expectations, and then you have the punchline, which is either exactly what you expected, or it's completely flips the whole thing around. And that's how good comedy works, and that's how horror works as well. The audience, of course, they've seen scary scenes before. They have certain expectations. Sometimes you want to give them what they expect. Sometimes you want to surprise them and make them realize that they've been misled on purpose. So that's something that I've studied in all of my horror films. And it's really, it's about timing. There's a famous story about Steven Spielberg when he did Jaws, one of the greatest horror films of all time, and how he ended up reshooting a certain scene in his editor's swimming pool several times to get the timing right of how you reveal something. Do you show first the reaction of the person and then reveal what they are seeing? Or do you see shock the audience and the person by showing what they see and then showing their reaction? How you time it and all that. It's very instinctual, but it's almost like science that, you know, when you explore it, when you shoot it, when you stage it, when you shoot it, when you edit it, you just have to find exactly the right rhythms.
So you're heading back to your shark horror roots soon with a new film, Deep Water. Obviously, you did Deep Blue Sea in the past. Do the two compare? And what should audiences expect from this new movie?
Good question. How do I answer that in a short way? I loved making Deep Blue Sea. I love that world. And I happen to love sharks. And I've done a lot of diving with sharks. So I wanted to just explore these ideas more. I wouldn't even call Deep Water a shark movie. It's like a 1970s disaster movie. It's an airplane that crashes into the ocean somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and the airplane crash sequence alone, I wanted to do the most massive crash sequence ever filmed. I hope it worked out. I feel like it did. The airplane crash itself is huge, and then the fact that the people end up in this broken up plane on this coral reef in the middle of nowhere, and those few that survive realize that they are surrounded by sharks. Kind of like the USS Indianapolis story in Jaws, when that warship went down and most of the sailors ended up, you know, they survived the sinking, but ended up being eaten by sharks. So it's that kind of a situation where there's no one bad shark. There's just tons of sharks. they are not bad. They are just, it's like wild animals. It's like if you were airdropped in the middle of Africa and you happen to land where all the lions live or the crocodiles, you know, it's their natural habitat and you're the outsider, and it's going to be a really hair-raising survival story. So again, Deepwater is a very realistic story, very emotional story. And like I said, it's like a 70s disaster movie where we get to know a bunch of characters and follow their journeys, how they navigate this horrible situation.
That was Rennie Harlin on The Strangers Chapter 1. That film was not screened in advance for critics, but if you fancy checking it out, it is in cinemas from Friday the 17th of May. Next, we're heading into the imagination of John Krasinski.
We've started the matchmaking agency to help ifs find new kids.
Or we just disappear.
Blue. Happy place, happy place.
Coffee and croissants. Coffee and croissants.
I can help you.
How?
Because I'm a kid.
You are the chosen one.
No. Let's not give her a complex.
Good luck, Short Sack. It's all up to you.
No pressure.
Cock and dagger!
Hope this works.
So this is If, which is the latest film from John Krasinski as writer, director and co-star as well. He's got an important supporting role here. It's very different from his A Quiet Place films in that this is sort of squarely aimed at families, very much in the family-friendly bracket. It's rated U in the UK. If you haven't kind of seen any trailers or read about it, the concept is we're sort of in a world where imaginary friends are real to some degree. Very much feels like John Krasinski trying to kind of do his take on a Pixar film. And we're following this young girl named B. Right at the beginning, we meet her when she's very young, and we get this kind of montage where we see that her mum dies. And then the main bulk of the story, we catch up with her like a few years later when she's 12. And at this point now, her dad, who's played by Krasinski himself, is ill, and he's kind of looking at some quite serious surgery, like sort of heart surgery he's in hospital for. So she is sort of set to be living with her grandmother, who's played by Fiona Shaw, in New York. And it's sort of around this time that B kind of runs into a guy, Cal, played by Ryan Reynolds, who has this thing that she also has, which is now that she can see everyone's imaginary friends just wandering around. And so this begins a kind of story for these two to basically go about trying to reunite these ifs, as they're called for short, imaginary friends, with, you know, their kids who've forgotten about them, or seeing if they can even set them up with new people perhaps. So that's the kind of, they become a sort of matchmaking service for imaginary friends. So that's the basic gist of it. And it has this again in keeping with the Pixar vibes, it has this Michael Giacchino score, which I actually really liked the sort of jaunty half of this score. But right from the beginning, it starts on the kind of syrupy sentimental side. And it's really overbearing and really sort of in your face, the use of this score. And to me, that kind of summed up the approach of the film as a whole. Like, how did you find it, Matthew?
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned about Garfield, which is obviously based on a very well-known IP and is no doubt geared towards starting a franchise, whereas this is kind of the opposite. This is quite a rare sort of all-star family movie that is based on an original idea. It's not necessarily setting up sequels, so it's kind of something you want to, you sort of will it on, you want to engage with it and enjoy it. But yeah, for me, it just didn't work really. I find it really hard to see who it's actually aimed at. I mean, I think children won't find it especially engaging because it's incredibly slow. There's very sort of little action. There's not much sort of urgency. There's no kind of race against the clock or like a deadline they have to meet. There's no kind of bad guys. I mean, films can sort of thrive without these elements, but I feel like they perhaps should have been included here to kind of give this film a bit more energy, because it is sort of lacking quite a lot of momentum. And it's not especially funny as well. It's we've seen the character Steve Carell plays, the character Blue, this big sort of Monsters, Inc. type furry blob who's very much at the forefront of the trailer and the poster. But he's kind of a side character, really. He has an arc, but it's not particularly central because there's so many of these other imaginary friends to cram in as well into this film. It sort of bites off a bit more than it can chew. And then there's the other sort of aspect. I mean, it's made sort of palatable and there's kind of a narrative explanation, but it is slightly uncomfortable to see that you've got a 12-year-old girl who's kind of knocking around with this, like, this 40-year-old stranger. She goes into his apartment in her building and just kind of starts hanging around with him. And the first time we meet him, we see him sneaking into a girl's bedroom and hiding under her bed. It just all feels just a bit sort of iffy to coin a phrase. And yeah, I struggled to really get past all these kind of stumbling blocks.
Yeah, I felt the same really, in that like I kept wanting to cut it slack for various reasons, such as I love the idea of there being an original film that just works. It's sort of for families and not a big action IP franchise, but you know, something kind of original, small scale, heartwarming. Yeah. I really want it to work. So I was kind of trying to be on the side for that. And then because I was trying to, you know, allow it somewhat that it's in this kind of like fantasy storybook world to an extent, you know, like not every film has to be set in like a grittily realistic world, of course, but just still things like that just kind of clang, like the fact this girl was just basically allowed to just wander off around New York with her sort of dad and grandmother seemingly just having no idea where she was. And she was just wandering about wherever she fancied it, whenever she fancied it, with no one seemingly caring where she was. And it was just this combination of things that, when all added up together, just made the whole film not really work for me. Like, didn't really sell the concept for me. Like I feel like imaginary friends are maybe a culturally different thing in the US, just based on this film and based on Inside Out and Bing Bong in that film. But I find it odd that people, you know, have these imaginary friends that I always just presumed an imaginary friend would be like a kid roughly the same age as you, that you would kind of conjure up if you were just a bit bored playing in your room on your own and you kind of wished you were playing Lego with someone else instead, you know, rather than just sitting there on your own doing it. But for the most part, these are all these kind of weird creatures, and some of them kind of make sense because some of them are sort of big, cuddly, or there's like a superhero dog, or there's like an astronaut or a unicorn. And those ones make sense to me, that a child might imagine those as an imaginary friend. But then there are some, like there's this ice cube in a glass, like this sort of sentient ice cube. Yeah. And there's like a banana.
Banana in a headband.
And things which just, and there's this kind of almost creepy, like detective type character in a trench coat. There's like this kind of shadowy face in a trench coat. And it's like, that just doesn't make sense to me why anyone would conjure this up as an imaginary friend. To be honest, the film just didn't convince me that it was a particularly good idea to cling on to imaginary friends. Like, it seems to me like anyone who does have an imaginary friend as a kid, it seems right that they let that go when they reach a certain age. Didn't really buy into the fact that there needed to be any reunions happening. And again, there's other things, other problems I had as we go further into the film that I just won't mention now. But I really, really struggle with this film and like wanted to like it. But yeah, just really couldn't get on board with it.
And there's all these a few little elements that kind of hint at what Krasinski might have been aiming for. Like, you've got the cinematographer Janusz Kaminski, who's obviously shot a lot of Spielberg's films, so it all looks very sort of pretty and golden hued, but I think he kind of misses the sort of wonder and charm of Spielberg's movies. And then there's a sort of a throwaway shot of a Calvin and Hobbes book at one point, and Calvin and Hobbes is kind of a perfect example of how you make a story about a child or a young person with an imaginary friend, because Calvin obviously had this stuffed tiger who came to life in his imagination and they went on all these great adventures. But that was always done in a very sort of witty, funny, charming way, whereas I think this just really kind of misses that mark for all its kind of noble intentions.
Because Calvin and Hobbes is just a perfect example of that, isn't it? How it sort of flits between. And I believe you mentioned as well previously to me about My Neighbor Totoro as a kind of comparison as well, which I hadn't thought about until you mentioned it to me. But that in a way is sort of a perfect comparison, because it's these kind of magical creatures emerge at this time of kind of family crisis, and it's all on a very sort of small scale, really. And it kind of shows how overwhelming it can be as a kid when, you know, a parent is ill and that kind of thing. But not many films can live up to My Neighbor Totoro, to be honest. But this is so far short of that, that when you did raise that comparison to me, I thought, oh, that was even more kind of damning of if, really. and to kind of like, you know, to sort of highlight a few positives, I thought Kaylee Fleming, who plays Bee, the main girl, I thought she was very likable, and she there's like an emotional moment she has to deliver that I thought she did a good job there. There's this one scene where they go to the kind of like if HQ, really, I suppose, it's based in Coney Island, and they're sort of basically walking through the building, And Ryan Reynolds' character is just kind of beset by all these different kind of characters and different themed rooms kind of coming to life in a way. And that to me was one time where it was kind of a sequence where I thought, oh yeah, I could see kind of kids digging this and sort of being delighted by it, because it did kind of unleash a bit of imagination and was just sort of visually fun and
a bit kind of silly.
So I liked that scene, but I feel like it needed much more of that, really, to kind of even stand a chance of working. And there's also this element as well, which certain things began to grate on me a bit with it. Like Krasinski's obviously kind of roped in a lot of mates for voice roles for these characters. And most of them, to be honest, most of them don't get that much of a look in. Obviously, Steve Carell is Blue, the main character. So there's this kind of office reunion going on there. But there's like, you know, there's cameos from people like Matt Damon, Emily Blunt, George Clooney. And sometimes they're even quite hard to identify because there's so many of them. And again, it just feels a bit like, I don't know, it just felt a bit smug and self-satisfied to me, like kind of like the rest of the film. And the overriding thing I came away from feeling about this was, it didn't feel like the concept had been thoroughly thought through. It felt like Krasinski came up with this idea that he liked, and he's mentioned a bit in the past about kind of wanting to make this film for his children, which is, you know, fair enough. But it feels like he just kind of came up with this idea and then didn't properly, like, you know, kick the tires and then didn't properly make it watertight like the best kind of Pixar films are.
Yeah, it's not quite rigorous.
And
you know?
Yeah, and so it just basically didn't work for me, I'm afraid to say. And I say that as someone who likes Krasinski. Like, I really like the first A Quiet Place. Yep. I enjoy him as an actor. He's very sort of, you know, charming personality.
Yeah, me too.
But it just didn't work. And I actually even have to say I found him a bit annoying in his role in the film as well, where he plays the dad of the girl, and so he's the one who's kind of undergoing surgery. But again, he's kind of cast himself as this kind of perfect dad again, and he's this perfect dad who's just always joking, you know, always just the loveliest dad. And I don't know why, it just irritates me.
We just can't live up to this model, John. Be more flawed.
Yeah, so all in all, it was a film that I'm afraid to say just didn't work for me.
No.
But if you do fancy giving that a try, that is If, and that is in cinemas from this Friday, the 17th of May. And now it's time for a grimy British debut.
It used to take me longer to remember Mother's voice, but I can hear her again.
Boy, what are you playing at?
I can smell a memory.
You're a funny little biscuit.
I've come to realise grief will never heal over time.
So this is Horde, which is like a very sort of hard film to explain and set up, but I'll give it a bit of a go in that it's a debut feature from Luna Carmoon, who sort of writes and directs. It's a story of a girl called Maria who we follow at kind of two points in her life, and it begins when she's sort of a much younger child, and there she's played by Lily Beau Leach. And she's with her mother, Cynthia, who's played by Hayley Squires, who you might remember from I, Daniel Blake. And where the title kind of begins to come from is her mum is a big hoarder, and the house is absolutely kind of teetering with rubbish and junk and sort of trinkets they've picked up. And their sort of main pastime together is that they go out sort of raiding bins and picking things up, be it kind of food that's just about still edible, or be it just little kind of knickknacks they find in the bins, things that she thinks might be useful, they kind of take them home. And so that the little house they live in is just overwhelmed with just stuff, like all this sort of detritus that's built up. And basically, following a tragedy, we then jump ahead to finding Maria as a sort of, you know, older teen, I suppose, by this point. And now she's played by Saura Lightfoot Leon, and she's living with a foster mother played by Samantha Spiro. And then one of her former foster children comes into her life again, and his name's Michael, and he's played by Joseph Quinn, who you might know from Stranger Things, and he's obviously going to be in the new Fantastic Four. And he's a kind of 20 something, and there's this sort of attraction between him and Maria. That's how the film then sort of develops from there. But beyond what I've kind of said in terms of plot, it's an immensely sort of grimy film. It kind of gets down and dirty with the details of this sort of life. For want of a sort of, you know, like a nicer description, it's very much kind of bodily fluid orientated. And there's kind of a lot of that kind of grimy aspects of intimacy is kind of, you know, on full display here. So it's very strange. And then on top of all that, there's, especially in the earlier scenes when Maria's younger, there's a weird, almost sort of like slight kind of fairy tale like quality to it almost. I felt a bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what did you think about this film, Matthew? Did you like it?
Yeah, kind of admired more than liked, I suppose. I did find it quite long. I mean, it's over 2 hours, and I've read interviews with the director where she said she wanted to, you know, include all this stuff. I mean, which kind of fits with the theme of the film, you know, not wanting to let stuff go, that she was quite fond of keeping in some images perhaps that didn't have any sort of real sort of plot function, but you know, she was very fond of them. But I think perhaps the main problem for me is that I think Hayley Squires is fantastic in it as the mum, as the kind of volatile, eccentric, but very sort of loving mum. And once she goes out of it, I felt the film kind of struggled to recover from that. I mean, you get Joseph Quinn comes into it and he does bring some of his own sort of volatile energy to it. But I found the sort of the psychosexual relationship between him and Maria, yeah, it does go to some quite sort of dark and grotesque places. And I found that the longer it went on, became slightly repulsed by it, really. I felt like it was slightly stretching the metaphor quite thin, really, this idea of holding on to things, you know, figuratively as well as literally. Yeah, I didn't think it was perhaps quite as successful as recent films. I mean, well, you've mentioned these, something like Scrapper and After Sun, these other sort of difficult parent-child relationships, these complicated dynamics. Yeah, I felt it didn't quite live up to those. So yeah, I think there's a lot kind of that's original about it and refreshing, but yeah, I did find it a little bit of a struggle to get through.
It was an interesting one because I did find myself weirdly compelled by it, especially particularly the first half, but even as it went on. And I thought, like, Sarah Lightfoot Leon, and this isn't like her first role, but it's a kind of first big significant breakout role.
Yeah.
I thought she was just kind of extremely compelling and one of those people that she fully kind of commits to it and just has that sort of intensity that you just feel like you've seen someone you're going to see more from in the future, like a kind of a really intriguing new sort of screen presence when you just get that feeling when you sort of see someone. That's how I felt with her in this. And I felt even despite all the kind of, yeah, the griminess and repulsion, I did feel myself weirdly compelled by it for sort of the most part. But it definitely is a bit much in places not just from some of the kind of grotesque elements. They've got the sort of grotesque bodily elements. But there's this sort of the attraction between Maria and Michael is kind of very like animalistic and sort of feral, really. And so there's a lot of like grunting and screaming and sort of growling, which to be honest, I just found a bit much at times. There are some kind of quite stomach churning things in this as well. It's rated 18, but there's some stomach churning things like the misuse of a packet of Fizz Whiz, for example, will linger long in my memory.
Put me off shepherd's pie as well.
so there is some sort of grossness to it, but like I say, I did actually also find there was something kind of compelling about it as well. And it did feel like that, you know, that Luna Carmoon has kind of shown herself as a sort of, you know, a singular voice. And
it is
kind of quite remarkable for a debut film in that way. So I'm sure like whatever she does next will be sort of followed closely. But yeah, basically an interesting film, but you definitely need a strong stomach for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you do fancy that is Horde, which is in cinemas from Friday the 17th of May. And now it's time for another kind of coming of age horror. This is Tiger Stripes. Matthew, I haven't seen this one yet, so could you set this up for us, please?
Yeah, so this is Malay language film. It's directed by Amanda Nell Yu. It's her directorial debut. It won the Grand Prix at Cannes last year. And it's in a way, it's kind of like a more sort of horror version of Turning Red, except this time the girl, about an 11-year-old girl, she turns into a tiger or a sort of a tiger type character. It's kind of sort of metaphorical and sort of magical realist. And she lives in this small village, and she starts going through these changes. So there's lots of kind of It's a metaphor for puberty, but she begins to get more sort of feral and develops these kind of weird bodily characteristics, and then starts launching these attacks on some of her other villages and friends, and eventually the adults kind of start taking steps to try and help her, or to try and remove this presence, this sort of animal presence that's in her. So it's kind of a coming of age movie in the sort of Turning Red vein. But also comparisons with things like Ginger Snaps as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask if it was like Ginger Snaps.
It does sort of lean more towards the sort of the body horror, and it has. It's unfortunately it's been censored in its home country. A lot of the elements that are to do with puberty and menstruation and coming of age, so it's kind of fallen foul of more sort of conservative elements. But yeah, as far as I know, we're getting the uncut version here. I really enjoyed it. It's got a really sort of kind of charming sort of low rent aspect to it in terms of the effects, when, you know, there's no sort of digital slickness with it. It's all sort of, it's like prosthetics and camera tricks. The character goes racing up a tree at one point, but it's kind of done in a very sort of almost like stop motion type of way, and I thought that kind of gave it a sort of a really nice kind of handmade energy. The narrative is maybe perhaps a bit repetitive, and perhaps doesn't quite sort of get to the point, the sort of turning points maybe perhaps quickly enough. But there is a great sequence when a kind of snake oil exorcist is brought in to try and deal with her, and that's very sort of amusing and tense at the same time. I thought this was really impressive debut and very enjoyable.
I mean, is it actually kind of scary, or is it more of a kind of like interesting sort of metaphorical sort of horror film?
Yeah, more sort of interesting rather than, there are maybe a couple of jump scares, but it doesn't kind of milk the suspense. It's not really sort of playing for suspense all the time. You know, there's a couple of moments like in the jungle where you're waiting for something to happen, but yeah, I wouldn't say it was too scary, and because of the sort of the makeup they use, it's not too wildly realistic. It's perhaps not likely to put the frighteners on people. It's very much more about the kind of the girl's journey, sort of literally and metaphorically. That's kind of where its heart lies, really.
Well, I'm intrigued by that, and I will try and catch that. And if you fancy catching that too, that is Tiger Stripes, which is in cinemas from Friday. And now for our final film of the week, a new documentary release.
To meet somebody unpredictable is like putting a bit of adventure in your life.
Trouble was coming. I couldn't take it anymore.
There was this sort of Bonnie and Clyde thing, zooming off with cops in the trees.
The police hauled her off to jail.
It was very, very dark.
She was everything you want a rock star to be. For me, everything you want a woman to be.
So this is Catching Fire, the story of Anita Pallenberg. Matthew, who is Anita Pallenberg for anyone who doesn't know?
Well, she's an actor, artist, model, and kind of well-known for her associations with the Rolling Stones, particularly Keith Richards, with who she had children in the 60s and 70s. And she was a big influence as well on their music and their musical direction. She has backup vocals on Sympathy for the Devil, which I learned from this film. And she was also in Barbarella, which is kind of interesting. Oh, okay. Because this week we've had the news that it looks like Edgar Wright and Sydney Sweeney are teaming up for a remake. And this is her life story. It's based on an unpublished memoir, and you have Scarlett Johansson reading passages from this unpublished memoir that was written before she died in 2017. And it's quite sort of linear sort of talking, like mixture of talking heads and archive footage. But Anita led such a kind of colourful, interesting life that kind of animates it, you know, it kind of gets it beyond that kind of strict that adherence to that format. There's lots of talk with her grown-up children, and it's kind of a cautionary tale in a way. I mean, it kind of tackles sex, drugs and rock and roll, and it shows the impact that all these things have on her and Keith Richards' children. It takes some very sort of tragic turns, twists and turns at different points. But it does kind of, it really kind of brings to light her character, because perhaps people will perhaps be aware of her, you know, from her roles in things like Barbarella and Performance, and that her association with the Rolling Stones. But it feels like it kind of gives her a due and gives her a voice. So it's quite illuminating as a portrait.
Sounds interesting, and it's distributed by Dogwoof, isn't it?
Yeah.
I find that their documentaries are always interesting, really. I think
yeah, they really are.
Can't really go too far wrong with this, but
no.
that does sound like that is another interesting one as well. So I will try and catch that one. But yeah. What would you say, Matthew, as the person who's watched all the films this week? What would be your film of the week?
I'm going to go for Tiger Stripes. Yeah, I found that the most engaging out of all of them. But yeah, very interesting crop of films, and lots of interesting parent-child dynamics going on in all these films, really.
I mean, who knows? Maybe The Strangers Chapter 1 could have been film of the week, but obviously wasn't screened in time for critics. No. So we'll never know. But yes, I feel like, I've only seen If and Horde out of these two films. So I'd have to pick Horde as the more interesting film. But yeah, obviously haven't seen those others as well. But we're approaching the end of the podcast now. Our Furiosa issue is still on shelves as the film revs up for its Cannes premiere. So look out for our review of that film coming out of the festival. And keep your eyes peeled for a look at our new issue, which you should be able to catch a glimpse of on social media as you listen to this. And don't forget, if you take out a subscription, you can get instant digital access to our current issue before your first print copy arrives. And we're currently running an offer where you can get your first 6 issues for $9.99. So if you fancy giving that a go, there will be a subscription link in the podcast notes. And talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe on your podcast app of choice. It really does make a difference, and it means you'll never miss a new episode. And also remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for one quick question. Matthew, if you could have any movie character as your imaginary friend, who would it be?
I think I'd go with Venom. Venom would be my buddy, the lethal protector, looking out for me. And he's a funny guy as well, isn't he? And he kind of does the right thing, you know. I mean, he often ends up biting people's heads off in a very sort of messy way, but he does strive to be better. So I'd go with him.
Perhaps this question has got a bit too broad, but yeah, I don't know. Like, in my head, I was thinking maybe like a Pixar character, like sort of Woody, maybe would be a nice imaginary friend to have, just a sort of reassuring cowboy by your side, you know, whenever times got tough. Or I've always had a soft spot for Mike Wazowski as well, and I kind of relate to him quite a lot as a sort of warrior and stuff. So I feel like maybe he'd be quite a good person for me to have around to sort of offload onto and to sort of share in his foibles. But
did you have an imaginary friend when you were a child?
No, I didn't. No, did you?
Yeah, well, briefly, I remember there was an episode of The A-Team where Howling Mad Murdoch had a dog, an imaginary dog. And I remember me and my friends at school for a couple of days after that pretended we had imaginary dogs. But obviously we were kind of piggybacking on the back of someone else's imaginations, sort of thus defeating the object of having an imaginary friend. But that was my one time.
My only real understanding of imaginary friends in my childhood came from Drop Dead Fred, the Rick Mayall film, which I absolutely loved. Just this kind of, like, I haven't seen it since childhood, but I loved it as a child because it was just so kind of crude, and I kind of couldn't believe that like an adult was getting away with making these kind of silly jokes. And
yeah,
you know,
that was Rick Mayall.
Rick Mayall. And talking about, I loved Bottom obviously as well, but
yeah, me too.
Just talking about, you know, the dog poo, like when he comes in his hands with dog poo in his shoes and sort of jumps on the sofa and all that kind of stuff. I loved it as a kid. And obviously Phoebe Cates, and that was the kind of, you know, with that and Gremlins, she was kind of, you know, one of the main stars of my sort of films of my youth. Yeah, so that was always to me what imaginary friends were. And even to the extent when I first heard that a couple of years ago, whenever it was, that John Krasinski and Ryan Reynolds were teaming up for an imaginary friends film, I pictured it to be something like that. You know, when that idea was first just planted in my head, I didn't picture it to be anything like a big cuddly family film. I thought it was going to be something a bit sort of crude and silly, but that was just that was just what Drop Dead Fred had got me thinking about when it comes to imaginary friends. But you know,
there's always this Harold and the Purple Crayon coming up.
Well, I mean, the trailer for that went down quite well with my son when he saw it, so I probably will be checking that out.
Yeah, me too.
But that's all from us this week, so thanks very much for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.